And I'm Tabitha.
And you are listening to Educators
Who Dare to Lead.
Stay tuned. Hey, Tabitha.
Fill in this sentence.
I grew up believing that vulnerability is...
private. Personal. Yeah. That's what comes to my head is like, it's not that it's not okay to be vulnerable, but it's more like, it's not something that you disclose or that you share with very many people at all.
Where did you grow up? And you don't have to answer that if that's too private.
I grew up kind of everywhere, but in general, my roots are in the South.
Okay. That is super interesting because I could not figure out what my answer to this question was because I literally never thought about vulnerability as even a thing. Hmm. I recognized the word. I could kind of tell you what it meant. But until I watched the TED Talk that Brené gave, because I used to just play TED Talks about leadership on this loop while I would do kind of a manual task. I had this huge manual task that I had to do a couple of years ago during the workday. And I was like, well, I have to do something. I was making something physical for the teachers. I was like making these plaques. And I was like, I've got to do something to further my learning. So I had this and I can remember working on these plaques and then hearing this TED Talk and hearing her talk about vulnerability. And I was like, what? Okay, sure. It never came to me that it was an important thing. And I did not know how I was going to answer that. But as soon as you did, I was like, yes. Mm-hmm. But I almost feel like that is equating vulnerability with disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
that will come later. She definitely talks about that in the chapter. So if that is something that you are wondering about, then I would read the book, that chapter for the book. But here's the thing that prompted my question for you. Where did you grow up? I grew up in the North, but I live in the South. And I remember, again, it's these things that we don't think about until we are in a different situation where we notice differences. I remember moving here and people asking me where I went to church and mm-hmm. being like, that's very private.
That's the first thing you ask people in the South. Like, what's your name? Where do you go to church?
It'd be like one thing if you volunteered, but that is something that you would not, at least where I grew up, I'm not speaking for the entire North or even defining what the North is.
Mm-hmm.
And it is something that you would bring into the conversation after you had known someone for a while. I think the benchmark for me would be, I go by Elizabeth, but people that are really familiar with me will call me Liz. But if you don't know me, it mm-hmm. feels weird to me that you would call me Liz. It's like when we were on the Liz timeline, then we would bring religion into the conversation. And I moved to the South, the middle of my junior year in high school. And some of the first conversations people would have with me would be where I went to church. And I would just be like, I don't even know how to answer this question because that is a vulnerable moment. That is like your spirituality. And it's,
yeah.
So that is something that makes me think about that. But this is all speaking to vulnerability because we have these definitions that are rooted in some learning. They usually start in our formative years.
Yeah.
We are going to talk about section one in part one, the moment and the myths. So tell us about the synopsis about what we're going to cover in our episode today.
Okay. So this section, Brené starts talking about what vulnerability actually is. So she gives a really great definition. She says that it's having the courage to show up when you can't control the outcome. And that just makes so much sense because yes. That's all of life, isn't it?
And it's definitely education.
Yeah. Realizing you can't control the outcome. That's period. But guess what? You still have to show up. So that's really what vulnerability is. And she goes through this section and talks about the different myths of what people have thought vulnerability is. And she kind of goes through and dispels each of them. So mm-hmm. she talks about how it's not, vulnerability is not the same as weakness. You know, there's no opting out of it. You've got to own it.
That's but myth you one. Need.
These are just all lumped together.
Okay.
So I'm just like giving. Okay, in general, here are the things that people maybe believe incorrectly about vulnerability. Okay. So she is correcting these myths by saying, hey, vulnerability is not the same as weakness. You can't opt out from it. You've got to own it. You need support. You've got to find your people who are going to support you through it. You can't eliminate that uncertainty, that risk, that emotional exposure. You have to be vulnerable while building trust, and you need people you trust in order to be vulnerable. So that's kind of a loop. Okay. You need both of those things that go hand in hand. And also then she talks about a little bit how vulnerability is not oversharing.
which is kind of what I thought. I was like, oh, that's what I thought. But it's,
yeah, exactly.
When she explains it, I was like, okay, yes. The model that she gives is really interesting. Do you want to talk about that now or later when we talk about how it connects to education, about the difference between being vulnerable and oversharing?
We can talk about it now.
So the example that she gives
is this the one where she talks to the, okay, go ahead if you found it.
Okay. Here is the example that she gives, except for I didn't find it. I found this section. It's this whole thing where somebody gives a quote about, like, I like theory, but there's something in my brain where I can totally miss the nuance. And I know that a lot of people miss nuance. That's kind of literally what nuance means. But I do really, really great with concrete examples. Okay. So here's the non-example of vulnerability. The guy says that what he's going to tell his team.
Oh, yeah.
Is.
I think I have it.
Okay, go for it.
I'm in completely over my head.
Yeah.
We're bleeding money. I have no idea what I'm doing. Like, that was his idea of how being he vulnerable. Was going to be vulnerable with his team that he was leaving at work.
Right. And that's the non-example. The good example is the one where he says, like, this is hard. I feel it too. Maybe it's earlier than I was thinking, because there's so much of this that connects with other pieces that sometimes I think it's going to be in one place and it's somewhere else. My goodness.
Well, whenever this is
the perfectionist part of me is like totally battling. I'm trying to find this quote, and in my brain, it is going, you have to model not being a perfectionist. It's okay to make mistakes. And then the other part of my brain is saying, you're hosting a podcast. You should have this quote already pulled. And then my other part is saying, no, Brene says we have to have self-compassion and you should model that. Like, I cannot be a perfectionist about not being a perfectionist. And that is what my brain is totally doing. Ah,
I love it. Cause we had a conversation before we even recorded this of, are we ready? Are we really ready? Should we do this now or should we do this later? And obviously, ultimately we decided we should do it now because we are modeling that, showing up with vulnerability and, transparency and fighting the perfectionism that we have. So that's totally what you guys are hearing right now.
I'm in the Kindle version and it is at 14% of the book, or I think all the locations will be specific to me. So just 14% of the book is where I'm in.
Okay.
So here is a difficult change and uncertainty and a daring leader example. These changes are coming hard and fast, and I know there's a lot of anxiety. I'm feeling it too. And it's hard to work through. They're not saying like, you know, hey guys, I have had this, and this on my plate. They're acknowledging the anxiety without having to spell it out, so people don't have to feel sorry for them. Mm-hmm. So the leader continues on. It's hard not to take it home. It's hard not to worry. And it's easy to want to look for someone to blame. I will share everything I can about the changes with you as soon as I can. Mm-hmm. I want to spend the next 45 minutes rumbling on how we're all managing the changes. Specifically, what does support from me look like? What questions can I try to answer? Are there any stories you want to check out with me? And any other questions you have? So the leader goes on, that example is a way to be vulnerable and acknowledge what is difficult about a situation without oversharing, to where people, you're almost giving ownership of your caretaking over to the people that you're leading by oversharing. Yeah. That was such great clarification for me to see those two examples side by side.
Yeah. And to me, what it really does is separate the details of the problem from the process that you're going to use to deal with the problem. So that's, and that's what this particular leader was doing and saying. And like, I acknowledge that the details of our situation are stressful or difficult, but what we need to focus on and what we need to talk about is the process of working through it rather than just zeroing in on how stressful the details are right now.
I think as a leader, or as if you are leading a school, this is a great model for you. If you're leading a classroom, or I think you would word this a little differently. Mm-hmm. But if you're a corporate trainer and you're that kind of educator, or you're in higher ed, or you are dealing with adults, it's really simplified way. I think you could write this down, practice it a couple times, get really comfortable with it, because it goes, it's so nice and concise. And then it goes straight into how this leader can support other people and how they can get other people comfortable with that. So just a great example. And again, that's at 14% of the book if you want to grab a hold of that. So much about this chapter was so impactful. I think we're going to say that for every chapter.
Yeah, I think so.
or section of the book. She doesn't really use chapters, but every episode that we do. Was there an impactful piece or quote that you found that's just something that you can carry with you in the future? And I have one if you want more time to process.
You tell yours first.
Okay.
And then I'll jump in.
This may belong better into where we really talk about the specific niche to training and being an educator, but it just rocked my world. I've read this book about 3 times, and this is my 4th run. And what is surprising to me is how every time I have a profound takeaway. And here's my profound takeaway from this one. So think about the educational terms of having a classroom that is academically safe. Put that in one hand or one part of your brain. And then think about creative thinking as far as whatever taxonomy you prefer. Bloom's depth of knowledge, solo, whatever it is, but the idea of creative thinking or creation. So you've got these two things, academically safe and creation. Now think about 2 quotes that she gives in this chapter. Here's the first one. Without vulnerability, there is no creativity or innovation. If we want our students to demonstrate creative thinking, we have to have vulnerability in there. But that's like, well, what does that mean? What does that look like? Does that mean we're not oversharing? So I think that was great that we clarified already. So we're not asking them to bare their soul to us. We're not having to do that for them. So what does that look like? Well, here's another quote. She says, fake vulnerability can look like a leader. So I'm going to put educator in there because that is a part of what we do as leaders. We are educators, we are leaders. So fake vulnerability can look like educators telling us we can ask questions, but not taking the time to create the psychological safety to do it, or not offering a pause in the conversation for anyone else to speak at all. In my mind, I'm placing my mind and heart in a classroom, whether you are doing it online right now or you are in a physical space. When we are asking our students to do creative thinking, or they're going to, we're saying you need to have a growth mindset. And that means that mistakes are proof that you're trying, and we learn from mistakes. You have to have the academic or psychological safety so that when people make mistakes, or when they go off skew, or when they're creative, but it's not really what you had in mind for that standard, you create a space and a response to where their self-worth is not in question. So, and it's not just, okay, here's the assignment. Does anyone have questions? And you count to 10 and give away time. That's a great start. But I think it's also, as the students are working, you might circulate the physical space. So if you're in a brick and mortar classroom, and like walk around and just kind of do like a check-in with people, like, you know, tell me what you're working on and let them talk and let them think through it. Or if you're in an online room, maybe you're sending some private messages and whatever kind of platform, like, you know, hey, can you tell me about this assignment? Or maybe you read the instructions and you ask all of the students to summarize what those expectations are, and then you can kind of go through and clarify. But it's important that we recognize that every single time a student turns in a piece of work, they are being forced to be vulnerable with us as educators.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. You are so right. And I don't know that I've ever thought about it that way before.
It makes me really curious so one of the more frustrating moments that we have is when we ask, does anyone have questions? Nobody answers. Mm-hmm. And then we get like, you know, 50% or more of the assignments where the instructions were clearly not followed. And we're like, oh, I wrote them down. They were clear. I asked if there were questions. Why don't they just read the directions? I wonder if, and I'm trying to think back of when we were a student ourselves, and I think that is a great practice when you are in a professional development or you are trying to work on something, to have everything with the lens of how do I feel as a new learner and how can I take that to help understand what students are feeling like. So when I'm a new learner, whether I'm learning like how to play a video game or professional development or anything, there's this anxiety that comes from trying something and not really knowing if I have the right answer. And that takes me extra time from the educator who's leading me, whether it's like, you know, my husband trying to teach me to play the game, or really, let's be honest, my kids, or a teacher trainer trying to teach me. They might think that I'm tuning out, especially if it's online, because they can't see my eyeballs glaze over or whatever. But really, I'm second guessing myself. I am like, okay, I'm going to do it this way. Wait, no, if I do it this way, I can't do it this way. Well, I did it. I'm thinking most recently, I became we took on the challenge to become New Zella certified educators. Mm-hmm. And that assignment took me 4 times as long as it probably needed to, because I didn't know how picky they were going to be. Every time we respond academically, we're being vulnerable. And I think having that in our hearts, as students don't respond or they respond incorrectly, it's not about us. So what is it about? How can we be curious about how vulnerability is showing up in those right answers or in those non-answers? Mm-hmm. What about you? What was the moment of this part for you?
It's interesting because I didn't read your notes about what was most impactful for you. I didn't read them ahead of time. I ended up with something very similar. What stood out to me the most was also that idea of psychological safety. And the things that stood out to me there, she goes through and explains, here are the things that detract or take away from that space of psychological safety. She says, if you have judgment going on, unsolicited advice, interrupting or sharing outside the team, those are your roadblocks. Those are the things that are going to prevent people from feeling that safe space. And the positives, on the other hand, these are the things you want to incorporate: listening, staying curious, being honest, and keeping confidence. So really that's the hugest part of this to me, is if we are expecting other people, the people that we work with, the people that we're leading, the people that we are teaching, if we're expecting them to be vulnerable, it's mm-hmm. our responsibility to give them a safe space so that they can be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And if we're not creating that environment, then we can't expect that from them. So I think that, I mean, that has ties to everything in life, but I do think it fits in really well with teaching and having a classroom full of students that you're leading.
One of the more powerful practices that we worked on together was this idea of recording yourself and then watching yourself and or swapping with a peer to watch with a specific lens to look through. Mm-hmm. If you are able to, I think online that can be easier as long as it's acceptable within your school and it complies with FERPA. If you are in the school building setting, it's the same thing. I have recorded activities with a camera, and it was usually presentations so that the students could watch themselves. But I, you know, just reach out to, if you have an instructional coach or a principal or whatever, and you want to do this activity, reach out to them. Otherwise, you could ask someone else to watch your class. But I think the most powerful tool that we have is the video recorder, because one, we are our worst critic, mm-hmm. but somehow that prevents us from listening to the feedback of others. So if you have an instructional coach or a peer come in and say, no, I don't think that your classroom is academically safe because you did X, Y, and Z, it is so hard not to shut down. But if you are watching yourself because you want, even if you tell somebody that's your goal, but you're watching someone yourself and your goal is to just be curious, how academically safe do I think my classroom is? I think it's super clear, because you can watch when students make mistakes. How do I respond? What is my tone like? And then just ask, if that was me, put yourself in seventh grade or second grade or kindergarten or ninth grade or even your time in college at that age, would I feel more, less, or about the same comfort level in volunteering again? Mm-hmm. And I think that is a really good indicator if your classroom is academically safe. There is a fantastic episode/blog article of Cult of Pedagogy by Jennifer Gonzalez. And it's called, Is Your Classroom Academically Safe? So if you want to dig more into that, that's a great resource that's specific for teachers. But the idea of psychological safety, I think you could replace almost every single time with academically safe. And this idea of what is the response when students are vulnerable or make mistakes, and have a good read and a good thing to come back to kind of like year after year. What else reminded you of, or what else did you tie to specifically to education from this section?
So the other thing that I was thinking of when she starts out this section by talking about feedback and how you need to be careful about the feedback that you are listening to and focusing on, and how yes, feedback is important. That is how we grow. But what you do not do is take all of the negative and hurtful comments from everyone around you and take it all to heart. And I think that speaks specifically to our day and age, just because, we're all about social media, and that's what mm-hmm. everyone is doing constantly, is giving each other feedback on what they're putting out there. And there can be a lot of negativity in that. Mm-hmm. But I think that from my experience as a teacher as well, like you're all the time getting feedback.
Totally. You're getting 360 degrees, like we talked about last time. Your students, their parents, your peers, mm-hmm. your instructional coach, your principal.
Yeah.
And then if anything else happens, please don't let anything that ever happens in the classroom make it to like the news or social media.
Yeah.
In that case, or even like in your school, that always affects everybody, because then people start talking about the school in general and lumping you in, which, you know, maybe is a good thing. But if you teach something where there is a performance and you put on a community night, you've got community feedback there too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So yeah. All these feedback and.
Yeah. So just being very aware of how you are taking in that feedback and what you are taking to heart and focusing on and what you are dismissing. Mm-hmm. So when you receive feedback, I think it's always good to stop and think about who it's coming from and why, and yeah. You know, what is their emotional state and what is their buy-in? Mm-hmm. And are they part of the group of people who is supporting you and yeah. who is wanting your growth and wanting your success or not? So I think that's pretty big to be able as a teacher or anyone in education to think through what feedback you are going to pay attention to and what you're going to be able to just let go of. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, when I started out coaching, I recognized how difficult it was to talk to teachers about their lessons because it's so personal.
It is.
It is so personal. It is like, as a teacher, like teaching was, it was my identity. It was who I was. So if someone's coming in saying, oh, that lesson that you handcrafted that came from your heart and soul, here's all the things that are wrong with it.
Yeah. And maybe you gave up a ton of family time or your whole weekend to get this ready.
Mm-hmm. It's so difficult. Oh, yeah. So remembering on both sides of that, whether you are in the capacity of an instructional coach or an administrator where you're helping guide teachers through mm-hmm. reflecting on their lessons, just think about how you're coming across, definitely. Mm-hmm. And also, if you're on the other side of that, if you're the teacher who's on the receiving end of the feedback, recognize that there are some comments that you're going to want to not pay attention to, but there mm-hmm. are some that are legitimate and we can't grow without feedback. So recognizing that it's not an attack on your self-worth, which is something you talked about too, Liz, with the students, just as you don't view it as a student giving the wrong answer or making a mistake. As a teacher, you don't view that as kicking them down a notch in their self-worth. If there are other people surrounding you and supporting you and giving you feedback on your teaching practices, and you know, helping you to be aware of where you need to grow, mm-hmm. then you shouldn't let that affect your self-worth either. And that's difficult.
It is difficult.
Those are the things that I thought about, you know, when I first started this section, and you know, she immediately jumped into feedback because feedback is something that's always hard for me. Like I tend to tear up and cry if someone is going to say something negative about something so personal to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, so it's so interesting. We're talking about feedback. So as coaches, we had to give feedback. You have to give feedback as a principal. You have to give feedback as a teacher. It's literally mm-hmm. a teaching tool. Academic feedback is a thing because it fuels growth.
Yeah.
It's a tool though, which in a strategy, which means that if you can recognize that the feedback that is being given to you is not the intention is not to help you grow, then you can see like, okay, that is, as she calls, like a cheap seat. She also talks about a square squad. I love how she'll say a problem and I'll just be like devastated saying, I recognize the truth and all of these things. And now I'm just devastated because I don't know what to do. And then she jumps into square squad or something else that lifts me back up and says, okay, I have a playbook. I can do something about this. So here's the idea. And I think it came from another book, maybe Daring Greatly. You take a 1-inch by 1-inch piece of paper. This is something that you would carry with you. And you write down the names of the people that will hold you to your values. So not just people that love everything that you do, but do so always out of love and respect for you. So there's not a lot of names on here. You would have that with you. I think ideally you would have a good mix, but it may not work that way. But you would have a good mix of personal, professional, maybe spiritual, all of the little facets of your life. You may want someone on there to where you could ask them, say, like, here is my lesson. Here is a definition for academically safe. Do you feel this classroom is academically safe? And you know that they will give you a kind, clear answer, yes or no. But maybe, you know, your spouse doesn't really know anything about education and wouldn't be able to answer that accurately. So I think you would want, maybe they don't belong on your square squad, but they're like in the perimeter, at least somebody professionally that could do that for you. We also talked about how 2 or 3 years ago, I had my square squad because I read this book about 3 years ago. And we were talking about this topic today. My square squad is different. And it will change over time because she has this great concept that her daughter brings to light, which is the marble jar, that trust is built over time with these small acts of being seen. So as you work with your peers, your instructional coaches, your parents that you support, all of these different people, as you work with all of these people, your spouses, your personal relationships, and they show you that they see you, that you matter to them, and it's these little tiny things over time. She says once their jar is full of marbles, like you give them a marble each time they do that, then you know they belong in your square squad. So if, I mean, I would be sad, but I imagine that there's a lot of people that may not have anybody in their life like that right now. You've just moved or you're isolated somehow. So that might be a first step, is to just open yourself up to new relationships. But here's the thing about the feedback from the parents. If you are in a school where you teach pre-K through 12th grade, where the parents are a huge stakeholder, not as much in adult learning, I still have emails from parents that rattle me, that kept me up at night for years, or I would have some kind of moment that would strike me back to there, and it would just like so much hurt for no reason. And she says, like, don't hold these to your heart. And that's where she's coming in with the square squad, is that you need to let the people matter who are on your squad. But here's the question I want to navigate with you, Tabitha, is you have to pay attention to trends. If you have 25 parents and like 9 of them are saying that there's an issue, I think you should recognize that there is an issue. Maybe it's the same one, or maybe it's different than what the parents are saying, and figure out like what to do about that issue and deal with that issue and hear what they have to say. But when it comes to parents and students, like, I don't know that a lot of parents and students would be on my square squad.
Right.
But we should listen to their feedback. So what would you say about that? And again, I love putting you on the spot here as I come up with some question.
Yeah. Okay. So I think how I would want to approach that is, when you get a piece of feedback, whether it's negative or positive or completely off the wall or it throws you for a loop, before dismissing it completely, I think you need to evaluate it and say, all right, is there any truth to it? Okay. And if you feel like you can't accurately judge whether there's truth to it or not, then take it to your square squad. Say, hey, Elizabeth, guess what? I got this email from a parent, and I'm not sure if it's legitimate or not. I'm not sure if this complaint is just, you know, has to do with me or has to do with that person and whatever they're going through externally that doesn't have anything to do with me at all. Can you help me work through it? Is this something that I should pay attention to? And then, you know, so you're right. If that parent who emailed me and was upset and angry is not on my square squad, but before dismissing their feedback, then maybe I'd take it to someone on my square squad and say, hey, is this real or not? And then you can figure out, okay, it's not, the issue that they brought up is not actually the real issue. So yeah. I can dismiss that, but maybe I need to do a little bit more digging to see, okay, well, what else is it? Why is it that they're so upset? Mm-hmm. And that may or may not be a problem that you can solve. It may be something where you're like, okay, that's out of my league. That's over my pay grade. That's not what I am called to handle or deal with. And then you can decide whether you're going to dismiss that and not take it to heart and not let it affect you and try not to let it keep you up at night. Or if it's something that you say, okay, I do need to work on making a change here.
As you were talking, I was thinking about the teacher, and then I started switching to the parent mode. Mm-hmm. To the number of times where there has been a concern and I have not said anything. I'm good at showing appreciation to teachers that I can tell really just do amazing things for my kiddos. But when there's something that I just do not like, that is hard. Like, if there's something that's harmful, I'm going to address that. My kids have had great teachers. That's not been an issue. But where, particularly around communication and patterns of communication and clarity or things like that, it can be an act of vulnerability to give feedback. Mm-hmm. And you just said that, like when you were giving feedback to a teacher in your role as an instructional coach, that required you to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So when we get feedback from parents, even if it's not, the intention seems skewed, I wonder if we could be curious about what's going on to where they took the steps to write this feedback, yeah. Use that language and send it. And it can be where we, instead of trying to take the feedback into our hearts, we actually want to see what's in their hearts.
Yeah.
And we can say, you know, hey, I got this email from you, Mrs. Smith. I could tell that this was something that was really on your mind. So I knew I needed to pick up the phone. When you say X, I'm really concerned, especially because I've taken steps for Y and Z. So thank you for this feedback, because that tells me I need to investigate something. Can you tell me more about this? And then it's not about you taking their feedback into their heart, whatever the issue is. Like they say your instructions are not clear, and you're like, I spend like 40% of my plan making my instructions clear. How could you say they're not clear? They're in 10 different spaces. That's the defensive part. That's armor. Right.
Yeah.
But you put down that armor and you get curious because you recognize that they are being, in a way, vulnerable, and also in a way not vulnerable because they're blaming you. Sure. But you can get to the vulnerable place with curiosity.
And one more thing that
yes.
that's reminding me of when you talked about defensiveness. So there are a couple of ways that you can get feedback on the feedback that you've gotten. So
I love that feedback on feedback.
Yeah. So like there, if I get a parent tells me or sends me something that immediately riles me up or makes me upset or sad or angry or confused, you can either take the approach of, hey, friend, I need some legitimate perspective on this. Or you can be like, oh my goodness, can you believe what this horrible parent just did? Don't you agree with me about yes. how I'm right and they're wrong? So, you know, it takes yeah. vulnerability on your part. You've got to put down that armor and be able to say, like, even when I'm talking through it with a friend, say, hey, this was my initial reaction. This is how it made me feel, but I need a different perspective in order to, you know, keep things objective. So remembering that, venting is good and necessary and needed sometimes, but you also have to be able to put that armor down.
Yeah. Maybe you vent to like somebody that's not a stakeholder in that situation. Like you can vent to your spouse, but then like be vulnerable about it with, assuming your spouse is not in your same profession. And then you'd be vulnerable with like that colleague.
With
that
your work BFF.
Yeah. And it's fine if your work BFF is in like a different grade. Maybe that makes it easier because cultures can be very different grade to grade. Or, you know, if it's you're in high school and your work BFF may actually be a college professor or something like that. Such good stuff. I want to be mindful of the idealistic versus the practical. So if you are processing this along with us and you're like, yeah, that's all great, but I can't get to know every student. I've got 120 students. How could I get to know every single one of them and put marbles in all their jars? Like, that is, you know, one, reach out to us on social media and talk, not be, be, I would encourage you to get to solutions finding with saying, how can I do this in this situation? And then as a community, we can come together to support you. If you say, I can't do this because of blah, 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 we will try to show up and be courageous and brave and help you through that and support you that. But just setting that up to your Square Squad or whoever you're trying to get feedback, when you start off with, I can't because of this, it's like, they're going to believe you and then they're going to be thinking that you can't. It's just so much easier if you can say, how can I, for those people that are trying to support you, to really support you. Anything else about how this is connecting specifically to educators?
I think we covered a lot. I think there's probably always going to be more that we can come up with, but those were the biggest things that were on my mind.
Okay. Looping back to prior learning. So all of our episodes after episode one will talk back about anything that we're discovering here that connects back to previous episodes. You might know those episodes far better than we do because we've listened to them a couple of times, but we're not re-listening to them as much as you might be, or maybe not, but I know that I probably know my favorite shows and the lines in those shows more than the people that performed the lines.
Yeah.
Because I watch them every year and they probably don't want to watch themselves. I don't know. But one of the things that we left off last time was this question of, when do you rumble and when do you let it rest? And at, it is 15% of the book. There is this quote where she talks about sharing. So I am going to replace sharing with rumbling and see if that works for you, Tabitha, and you can clarify because I'm just guessing here. Okay. We have to think about why we're rumbling and, equally important, with whom. Mm-hmm. What are their roles? What is our role? Is this rumbling productive and appropriate? Is that a good guideline for knowing when you're going to rumble and when you're going to rest? And why do you think that?
I think it absolutely is. I think it is because you are creating boundaries and you're saying, okay, you kind of have to identify your values and your goals and set your boundaries before you can do this. And then when you're faced with a person or a situation where you're like, okay, what do I do with it? Then you can evaluate it based on your predetermined values and what fits in with that system and what is outside of that system that you're going to say, I'm going to let that go for now. That's not within my, my box. That's not within my boundary. That's not helping me meet whatever goal it is that I have for myself in my life right now. So I'm going to leave that alone.
Right after I asked the question, the idea of boundaries popped in my mind. And then you said boundaries and I was listening to you. And I think you're so right. As we go through the book, like, that was a question we wanted to answer in the introduction. Yeah. I don't think the answer is in the introduction. I think we'll get there by the end of the book. When we talk about clarity, when we talk about boundaries, when we talk about knowing and leaning into your values, I think at that point we'll know, like, oh, this is not my rumble to own. Like, this person can think that and they may always think that. And it is not on me to correct their perspective. If they hate me, I always show up in my values. They'll just have to hate me. I've got enough people in my square squad where my value doesn't come from how many people like me. Mm-hmm. It comes from knowing who I am and liking myself. Oh, every time we go through this, I feel like I've been in a therapy session. All right. Let's go to, for next time, one of the simplest quotes that has completely shook my world. It is three words or the whole thing. It is clear as kind, unclear as unkind. That I think did more for my growth as an instructional coach, as a leader, as an educator, as a mom, as a wife, as a friend, as a human, as a person in this community than anything else. And we're going to talk about that in section two, which is the call to courage. It's about 17, it begins at 17% into the Kindle book, if you have the Kindle book.
Page 45, if you're reading I have the hardcover copy.
Okay. And I also have the audiobook. This is one of the first books where I have the audiobook. So Brené, and she does a great job reading. You can hear her intention and her words and her humor come in, but I will listen to her read it and read it. So that way I will have no distractions because otherwise I'll be like doing the dishes or, you know, trying to, I don't know, like watch my kids jump on the trampoline while I'm reading this book. And you just can't, if you want to take this into your heart, you can't multitask. Mm-hmm. But this section two, the call to courage, is about 45 minutes long again. So if you want to think about that, it's going to be about 45 minutes of your time if you want to read that ahead of time for our next time. So what is your hope for growth? Taking everything in this moment in the myths or even in the introduction that you'd like to think about for next time.
So I think from this chapter, one of the things that stood out to me was kind of defining your square squad and figuring out who are the people that I trust to be vulnerable with and who do I want to get feedback from. So just really thinking through for myself, who are those people in my life? And if I feel like I don't have enough of those people, then okay, well, what am I going to do about it? Like, it's up to me to go out and find a support network, because, you know, one of the things she says is you can't do it alone. Like, you need other people. You need that support system. So I think that is what I'm left with, is thinking through who's my square squad and what am I looking for in a square squad?
So mine is the marble jar. In a really like practical and meaningful way, looking around me and having the intention of seeing people and letting them know that I see them, and obviously in a respectful way, not creepy. Which actually ties back to something I wanted to ask you, because I don't remember what your hope for growth was last time. And when we were thinking about this one, I felt so bad about it, in that I think that is something I have to grow on, is like really paying attention to other people and their needs and what they're thinking and their processing. This is my brain is, I feel like it's always just like a bunch of fireworks and zigzags and focusing on who I'm talking to. And I apologize for that. What was your growth for last time from the episode? Do you remember?
Self-awareness and self-love.
Do you have an update on that?
Okay. It's a very small update, because the time, the real time between recording that episode and recording this episode is like less than 24 hours. But I will say that within those hours, what I have been able to do is say, ask myself, okay, what are my needs right now? How do I need to take care of myself? And what do I need to accept about my mistakes or imperfections or shortcomings And part of that, you know, in all transparency, was feeling like I wasn't prepared to talk about this section and to record this episode. And, you know, we had a conversation about it, and I was okay, because I said to myself, you did what you needed to do to give yourself rest and to recharge and to do what you needed. And so I was able to feel calm and accepting of my choices and the outcomes.
Well, and I knew that you were going to do amazing. So it was just a matter of saying, okay, we can record later, but I know you, and I know that you are always present, and that is what we need in the podcast. So of those two things, like, I was like, do I need to acknowledge what you're saying and we do that, or do you need a push? And I wasn't sure. So I just offered both. But to me, that is kind of how we show up as like a marble. I guess I do add marbles. I just am not great at the detail stuff. So, you know, if you're like, okay, I want to be supportive, what do? I want to do this and do that. Well, according to my quote from last time, the only way out is through. You just ask which one they need. Mm-hmm. Or you just say, as Renee said in this one, what does support from me look like? Oh, I love that. I want to talk about 10 more things, but we have, fortunately, like 8 more episodes. So your call to action is to either write down your square squad, get your 1-inch by 1-inch piece of paper. There are scissors. I mean, we're not perfectionists here. So like, nobody is going to come out and take a ruler to your square squad paper and measure it. Just get it done. It doesn't matter. It's fine. Brene is not going to be disappointing if your square squad is not exactly 1 inch. And write down the names of the people that you trust. You do not have to fill it out. We're not going for perfection. It can have some blank space. Maybe you have a couple, but she says it's got to be small so you can edit. And I think that doesn't mean that those people are not important to you. It just means that at this point, their marble jars are not full, and it may be not full yet. And you may have people in your life that eventually kind of come off, and then more people come on, and that's okay too. You're not talking about the value of their friendship. You're talking about the trust that you have, that these are people you can go to. And then she talks about just saying thank you to those people. So that would be the call to action. I would suggest you can define your own call to action. We'd love to hear from you on our social media. You can go to
Facebook, Educators Who Dare to Lead. That is our page. Or if you want to follow us individually, I am on Instagram at Virtually Tabitha, and on LinkedIn at Tabitha Securas, Securas.
And I am on Instagram under Elizabeth Walker Ike. My last name is spelled E-K, but it's pronounced Ike. And then I'm on LinkedIn under Elizabeth Ike. So Elizabeth space E-K. And you can connect with us on that Facebook page as well. Until next time, we hope that you dare to leave.